This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. If a citizen or group of citizens are not happy with the way things are, how can they get involved, share their ideas with political leaders, and actually influence change in the system? How do the governmental layers of our local city, county, and state entities cooperate and influence each other? And what motivates a public servant? These are some of the topics to be addressed today by a panel of three Utah lawmakers. The panelists include Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox. Cox is a Republican who previously served as mayor for Fairview City and as a San Pete County Commissioner and as a state representative. Also speaking today is Utah Supreme Court Justice Christine Durham. Durham has served on Utah's highest court since 1982 and served as Chief Justice and Chair of the Utah Judicial Council for 10 years. Also on the panel today is Utah State Representative Brian King, a Democrat who currently serves Salt Lake City's District 28. King formerly worked as an attorney representing plaintiffs with insurance claims. The moderator for today's panel is Michelle Olderoyd, an adjunct professor in the College of Law at the University of Utah. This Hinckley Institute Radio Hour was recorded live with an audience of students and faculty at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on April 22nd, 2014.
And we're going to begin actually briefly with a quick discussion that will hopefully give you a glimpse of our panelists on a slightly more personal level, asking each of them to share with us a story or a quote about their own civic hero, perhaps someone living, dead, or even a fictional character who represents what they think of makes a good citizen. So I'll turn the time over to each panelist to share with us briefly, by way of introduction, those initial comments.
You want me to go first?
Please, Michelle? Thank you.
Okay. Well, I'm excited to be here. As I was thinking about this question, there were many people that kind of popped into my mind. But the first one for me, when I was 8 years old, I had an opportunity to travel with my family back to Washington, D.C. I had an uncle who lived back there and worked for the CIA. And again, as an 8-year-old kid, I wasn't really that interested in history or politics or anything like that. But my family took an afternoon and we went down to Monticello, where Thomas Jefferson lived. And for whatever reason, the 8-year-old me was very much impacted by him, the place where he lived, the things that he did and accomplished. And then obviously we toured Washington, D.C. and were able to go to the Jefferson Memorial. And my parents bought me a book. In fact, it was titled My First Book About Thomas Jefferson. It was a really great title. And I still have that book. And for whatever reason, again, he kind of stuck with me. And his is a life that I've studied a lot. Just finished another biography on him, and someone who again served his country very valiantly, and somebody I've tried to pattern my own service after.
Tremendous. Thank you. Justice Durham.
Okay, I'm going to cheat and talk about two people. the first is a judge named Frank Johnson. Was a federal district judge in the state, I believe, of Alabama. Frank Johnson was one of the many federal judges, and there have been several books written about this era in American history, during which the South was being desegregated after the Brown versus Board of Education decision. And there were a series of federal judges who were truly heroic in their willingness. They grew up in these communities. They lived in these communities. There was enormous hostility to the work that they were doing to eliminate racial barriers in education and in public accommodation and in other places. But Frank Johnson wrote a series of immensely important decisions and created a pattern of leadership and courage that was followed by many other federal judges. If you're interested in this era, there's a wonderful book called Let Them Be Judged about that time in our history. And so I admire him for the courage that he demonstrated as a part of his professional calling as a judge. The other person I want to mention is much more local and in a very different sphere, not necessarily pertaining to my branch of government, but that's the woman for whom the Carmen Pingree School for Autism is named, over on Guardsman's Way. You've probably been past it. Now, when we first moved to Utah in the early 70s, we met the Pingrees. Carmen and her husband John have a son, Brian, with autism, and this was over 40 years ago. And you need to understand that over 40 years ago, very little was known about the origins, the causes of autism. The prevailing theory was that it was a result of emotional deprivation created by mothers. They used to talk about refrigerator mothers who caused their children to grow up with autism. and so on. And Carmen, in particular, with the support of John and her family, but she set out to change the public perception of that condition and the educational and community integration opportunities for people like that. And she contributed more than any other single individual to the way in which autism is handled and managed in our public schools, the community programs that are available for support, the education that's gone on in the medical community. Obviously, she didn't do it alone. But I wanted to mention her in particular because it wasn't her job. She wasn't getting paid for it. But it was her passion. She had a son whose needs were not being met, and she knew that the community had to change in significant ways before those needs and the needs of all the other children like him could begin to be met. And so her story reflects to me, I'm the parent of a child with significant disabilities as well. My daughter, who's about Brian's age, a little bit younger, has Down syndrome. And my daughter has benefited from the work that Carmen did and many other pioneers in the arena of public education for people with disabilities. So the take-home message from that second incident is that being a good citizen requires that you be passionate about something. I mean, if you're just doing it to be a do-gooder and you're just getting engaged because you think you ought to, I doubt that you're going to be successful. You have to be passionate. You have to have a story. You have to see a need that you think needs to be responded to, and then your response will be effective.
Well, I kind of feel like I'm the weak end of this triad here. We've got Justice Durham, who's one of my heroes in the judiciary here in the state of Utah. And Spencer Cox is a good friend. He and I served together in the House of Representatives, and I was thrilled to see the governor exercise the good judgment to call him his lieutenant governor. So my congratulations to Spencer. You know, there are a lot of people that come to mind when I think about this question of, about political heroes. Nelson Mandela, who of course recently passed away, is just a tremendous political hero for so many. And for me, as I've gotten to know more about his life and his story and his journey, it's an inspiration. I think of Martin Luther King Jr. I've gained greater information and knowledge about his journey and the contribution that he's made to the United States and particularly the civil rights movement. I fall back on a statement from John F. Kennedy, though, that you've all heard before many times. Ask not what you or a country can do for you, but ask what you can do for your country. And to me, that sort of epitomizes and capsulizes the important thing about public service, which is it's inherently looking out for something other than one's own immediate self-interest. And that's, I think, something that good public servants have in common. They're not looking for the immediate return on investment to themselves. They're looking for a return on investment to a larger group. And as Justice Durham said, for some individuals, it's as immediate as a family member who has great needs. There is something that I think motivates most great public servants that is very personal. I think that's true for me. But it's not so much a particular one incident that I can isolate and identify for you as it is more just sort of a gestalt that I've been speaking a lot to Democratic conventions around the counties. I was up just Saturday speaking to the Davis County Convention, spoke to the Wasatch County Convention and the Utah County Convention earlier this month. And one of the things that I conclude my comments with is, I refuse to live in a state like this, and I'm not leaving. And that's something I think that people who are animated by a desire to serve the public, and to whether it's in the legislative or the executive or the judicial branch, they're motivated by. That's a guiding principle for them, is that they're A, dissatisfied with the status quo to one degree or another, and B, they are not going to quit. They're both dissatisfied and loyal to the status quo. They're working from within to change in a positive direction. And that's very important to me personally, and I'm committed to that idea. I think good public servants are. That's a common theme for each of them.
We all think that those civic heroes give us a good glimpse about the virtues of good citizenship, but now let's talk about something more concrete. From the perspective of each of your branches, how can Utahns contribute directly to the branches of government? What can each citizen do in their day-to-day lives, even if their public role isn't one of service to the wider community and they're working in an individual capacity somewhere, or if they do have a particular issue that they're called toward, what can they do to impact your respective branch of government?
Do you have a preference on who starts?
Let's go the reverse order.
All right, I'd be happy to start. You know, it's a great question, and it was a question that we were told to prepare for, and I thought, oh, I love this question. I can't tell you how many times I have had people call me within the district, sometimes outside the district, and say, I got a great idea. And they tell me this idea. Sometimes I go, that's a lousy idea. Sometimes I think, it's a great idea, but it sure needs a lot of work, because what the people that are calling me oftentimes just don't understand is, from my perspective as a legislator, the logistics of taking an idea and getting it in bill form and then having it realistically have a prospect for passing. I mean, those are all very different things. But the thing that's critical from my perspective as a legislator is, look, I'm a lawyer. I spend every day representing folks who have had denied life and health and disability claims, and I love my work. I basically sue insurance companies. It's great. You can't imagine how well I sleep. But it's focused. It's specialized. And I'm not much different than anybody else up there. I mean, everybody in the legislature has their own life experiences that they come from, and very few of us are anything other than, you know, generalists in the vast majority of fields. I'm a specialist in a very narrow area, and I have a great deal of knowledge about that area, but quite honestly, very few bills come before us that I can speak intelligently about based on my own knowledge and experience. And that's true for everyone in the body. We are all generalists, and we all rely on the information that's brought to us by others who have greater knowledge about the particular bill that we're talking about. Sometimes if it's elections, it's folks from the Lieutenant Governor's office who say, look, we're the specialists on elections here in the state of Utah. If it's a health issue, it's the Department of Health. Or if it's education, it's teachers and administrators, school administrators, or maybe it's the governor's advisor on education or something. But we rely on other people who have greater knowledge. So the critical thing from my perspective in response to that question dealing with the legislature is, I depend on individuals within my district and others who have knowledge about an area and who I can trust to give me information that's accurate, that's objectively fair, that is information that I can rely on in making my own decision as the representative for my district about how to vote on a particular bill, or maybe be a co-sponsor of a particular piece of legislation, or be the primary sponsor for a particular piece of legislation. So the idea that we need, from a legislative perspective, the input of regular folks out there in the community is absolutely foundational to me doing my job effectively as a legislator. I'll tell you one specific example. I have a woman who's become a good friend just in a very short period of time. I first met her during this last session. She said, I'm a teacher and I have some education issues. I said, great, we exchanged some information. But she's kept in touch with me since then, and at the end of the session, she sent to me some information. She said, here's something that you ought to look at that we need to do more about in Utah. And she sent me a link to human trafficking, the Polaris Project. If you've heard of the Polaris Project, they do a lot of work regarding human trafficking. And they did some rankings of the states, and Utah really came out fairly low on the rankings. And I've since then looked into what it is that we could do from a state perspective to improve how we deal with human trafficking problems in the state of Utah, and I've got some good ideas. And it all came from her. I would never have stumbled across this myself. It resonates with me when somebody brings it to my attention, I look into it, but it's not something independently that I have time to look into myself. So that's the role that, from my perspective as a legislator, citizens can play.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW, and a panel discussion with Utah public officials representing our local legislative, executive, and judicial branches of government Coming up, former Utah Supreme Court Justice Christine Durham and current Utah Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox share their views on what Utah citizens can do to impact their respective branches of government. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. If you're just joining us, we're airing a panel discussion on what it means to be a good citizen in Utah. Speaking next is Utah Supreme Court Justice Christine Durham.
It's a little more difficult and abstract to talk about the ways in which citizens can support and contribute to the work of the judiciary, but I do have several very definite ideas, one of which is, how many of you know the difference between the federal and the state courts? Okay, so you read an article, you see a decision by a judge. Do you check to see, is that in federal court? Is that in state court? Is it a trial court or an appellate court decision? What's the court of last resort, namely the highest court that will be reviewing that decision? One of the things that I think that citizens owe their government and owe their country as citizens is a nuanced understanding of the way in which the judiciary works and the degree to which the judiciary exists for purposes of protecting the rights of individuals vis-a-vis other individuals and vis-a-vis the government itself. I've been very interested in some of the rhetoric that's quite common around some recent legislation. Recent judicial decisions in which in the instances I'm thinking of, federal courts have interpreted the federal constitution, which, by the way, is different from state courts interpreting state constitutions, although the work is similar, and people have complained that their decisions overcome the will of the majority of the people, that they're going against the majority. And by that they mean that in some instances they've set aside or blocked the application of laws that have been passed by the people's representatives in the legislative branch. But what often is not accounted for in that discussion is the fact that the judge's loyalty and affinity is to the Constitution, which is the will of the people. It is in our constitutions that we have enshrined our most fundamental values and protected our most treasured rights, so that we are not completely governed in this nation by majority rule, except insofar as that has been enshrined in our founding documents. And so I think that our discussions about the judiciary, about judicial decisions and the work of the judiciary, always need to be informed by a good understanding of a constitutional democracy and the role that the legislative branch, the judicial branch, and the executive branch play within that. So I'm really big on civic education. Thank you for the work that you do, Michelle, with the commission. The other thing I want to say is there are lots of volunteer opportunities. We ask for citizen representation in rating our courts, in working, for example, as guardians ad litem. Court-appointed volunteers in the juvenile courts who actually get trained and work with families and particularly children who are in the juvenile court systems and particularly in the foster care systems. We look for citizens who will serve on a multitude of committees that work on issues that will make the courts more efficient, more responsive, better educated. And then the final thing goes back to something that Representative King talked about, and that is the fact, how many of you are eligible to vote? Okay, and you all, being students here at the Hinckley Institute, you vote, right? And you read the voter information pamphlet when you vote. Do you get all the way to the end of the ballot and read about the judges and vote for the judges? And when you educate yourself about your legislators, do you pay attention to the way they vote on bills associated with the judiciary? Because the legislature has a lot to do with the way in which the judiciary, the state judiciary, is structured, paid, funded, the projects it can launch, the kind of support it can garner amongst the people. So the obligation to be an informed voter is very relevant to the health and strength of the judiciary.
Well, my answer will just kind of piggyback on the things that have already been
perils
said.
Perils of going last.
Yeah, that's right. But it is important. I would say more than anything, do something. Whatever that is, just do something. Something that you love, something that you care about. Growing up, I grew up in a small town in rural Utah, and my parents kind of distilled that in us, that you have to do something to give back. We all have an obligation to give back to our communities, to make them better than we found them. And all my cousins are volunteer firefighters and EMTs, and they do these wonderful things, and I was awful at all of those things. I just did not have an aptitude for that. I made the mistake of going to law school and realized, you know, that I was basically good for nothing when I got out, and had an opportunity to serve and give back. And so when I say do something, again, what is it you're passionate about? What do you love? Everybody loves something, and they love to complain about something. Either one of those things can be channeled into doing something to make our communities better. The other thing I would say, and Brian said this, I'll just kind of focus in on it, is it's a lot easier to get involved than you think it is. We have this, there's kind of this fog that hangs over government that we think, oh, it's too complicated, it's too difficult, they would never listen to me. And that's just not true. The thing that shocked me the most about serving in the legislature, and to be honest, as a lieutenant governor, isn't how many people want to tell me what to do, it's how few people want to tell me what to do. And it's so much easier if you just reach out. You think, I'm just a college student. Yeah, we listen to college students too, especially if you're one of my constituents. Then I'm much more likely to listen to you. Most of the information we get, especially as a legislator, comes from people outside my district who, you know, are blast emailing all of the legislators. But when I actually get a phone call or a text or an email from somebody in my district, I pay special attention to that. There's only 3 million people here in the state of Utah. Now, I say only 3 million. To put that into context, at the time of the Revolutionary War, anybody know how many people lived in the then 13 colonies? 3 million people. It was exactly the same as the United States. So think about that just a little bit. Again, put it into context. We are approachable. We are accessible. If you want to meet with me, I had a student from the University of Utah who was here from France working on a paper on a long shot. He just called my office and said, hey, I'd like to talk to the lieutenant governor. I know I probably can't do that. The next day, we had an appointment, and we had a half-hour chat. So we are accessible. You really can do those things.
Wonderful. And we're hoping that this discussion is accessible to you as well. If you have questions or comments, you can feel free to raise your hand and let us know that. If you'd like to participate with the panelists, there's a microphone available to you, but please ensure you wait for the microphone to make your comments or to lend a question to our discussion. We'll use some of your previous comments to kind of segue our discussion now. We talked briefly and listened to you discuss briefly how a good citizen has to be both loyal to the notion of the rule of law and the virtues of our government, while simultaneously perhaps finding something to be dissatisfied with in the status quo, that there's sort of a dichotomy to all good citizenship that comes from that tension. So what if you do want to change an institution or perhaps help it catch up to something that you perceive of as more contemporary than when it was founded? If a citizen is really wanting to influence your branch of government but do that by way of bringing revolution or change, how should they accomplish that in your mind in both a respectful and a productive manner? Should we go the reverse?
Well, let me start, because I'm not sure how much I have to say on this particular topic, because the courts exist to process disputes. We are a dispute resolution institution. And so the people who come to us are people who are asking for decisions from the courts. But when you look at the courts as an institution in terms of a branch of government and part of the tripartite system, then you have to talk about how do you preserve the independence of the decision-making process so that it is without fear or favor that judges make their decisions. But at the same time, how do you protect the accountability that citizens deserve from a branch of government, namely efficiency in operations, good use of public funds, timely decisions, the kind of performance on the part of the judiciary and its staff that citizens are entitled to affect. And I guess the first thing I would say, if you if you are dissatisfied, if you have complaints, the first thing you owe yourself and the institution is to learn about it, to find out how the thing you're dissatisfied about occurred and came about and get the facts, and then figure out ways in which you can influence. I mean, if you're concerned about the content of the decisions of the Utah Supreme Court, you probably don't have a lot of avenues unless you can get a case before us and make arguments in briefs and before the court. But if you're concerned about the way jurors are treated, if you're concerned about the way in which security is managed at our courthouses, if you think that there are judges who are not treating litigants well, there are numerous avenues from complaints directly to the court processes themselves or through the Judicial Conduct Commission or through the Judicial Performance Evaluation Commission, which is independent of the judiciary. There are a lot of ways that you can get your dissatisfactions addressed, so that's probably enough.
Thank you.
I think I would echo Justice Durham's comments about the judiciary in the sense that I'm a member, I'm the vice chair of the Judicial Conduct Commission here in Utah. It's a great commission to be on in the sense that it involves legislators, lay citizens, and members of the judiciary in evaluating complaints that are brought before us about the conduct of particular judges. Now, a lot of complaints about judges go up through the appellate system because they're allegations of errors in how the judge's decision came, what the judge's decision was in a particular case. That's not what we deal with. We deal more with judicial misconduct. And a complaint can be filed there, but I think the comments from Justice Durham highlight one thing that you have to be realistic about, which is the institutions that we're talking about here are not institutions that are easily or quickly changed to any fundamental degree. They are what they are. When you're talking about changes, however, in a legislative context to a particular law, it's an easy thing to call me, whether I'm your representative or not, and say, look, I got an idea. I think here's a problem. What do you think about this? And then provide information that, from my perspective as a legislator, gives me an opportunity to decide whether it's appropriate to take that idea and shape it to the point that it can be a viable piece of legislation to go through the process. And it is a process. And it's not an easy process to get a bill passed through. You've got to get 38 votes out of 75 members of the House. You've got to get 15 votes out of 29 members of the Senate. And then you've got to get one executive branch member to sign off, Governor Herbert. That's the math, 38, 15, and 1. And anybody in the legislature, if you say to a legislator, do you know what, do these numbers mean anything to you? 38, 15, and 1, they will smile knowingly. And they will say, yes, I know how to count.
Well, and you know, I would just interject, too. I said you can't change judges' decisions as citizens, but that's not entirely true. Much of what we do is the interpretation of statutes and the development of the common law. And those are arenas in which the legislature can change our decisions. So if we interpret a statute
right.
in a particular way and citizens don't think it's right or legislators
and
don't think it's
right. And many's the time that
or the governor doesn't think it's right.
Yeah, many's the time that we have been approached as a legislature and said, the Supreme Court did this last year.
Just done the stupidest thing.
We need to do something different. We need to fix it. And sometimes the Supreme Court, quite honestly, invites legislative right. action in their decisions by saying, our hands are tied in what we can do and what we can't do because the statute says this. And maybe the legislature needs to deal with it. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. And so it's an interesting relationship. It's not a hostile adversarial relationship, or at least it doesn't
not
have
often.
To be. Not often. It doesn't have to be.
Not always.
Sometimes it is, but not very often.
What I would add to this, when we're talking about changing institutions and revolution, I've already mentioned the kind of Revolutionary War, and we know the way that that was waged and the changes that were brought about. And there is a segment of our society that thinks that needs to happen
again.
Wants
to do that again regularly.
We saw this in Nevada just a few weeks ago. Those of you that followed, the BLM was confiscating some cattle. We had militia showing up. We had people with weapons on bridges. I was down there meeting with the director of the BLM. It was an interesting time, a scary time. I don't advocate that way, but we are seeing changes happening to institutions. We're seeing social changes happening to institutions. The miracle of the system we have set up is that we're able to instigate those changes without bloodshed. by and large. We've talked about the civil rights movement. There was some bloodshed, unfortunately. But we've had these kind of peaceful revolutions and changes that go through. They take time. It takes a tremendous amount of patience, but it takes passion as well. The only thing I would caution, again, you all have the secret, and I think we're going to talk about this a little later, about how to instigate this kind of change, because you're all experts in social media and in communication and in ways to get people to understand your own, your beliefs and your reasoning. There's a quote that I love, and it comes from a member of the judiciary, Judge Learned Hand, and he was talking about the spirit of liberty, and I wanted to read it just to make sure I got it right, but he says, excuse me, the spirit of liberty is the spirit which is not too sure that it is right. The spirit of liberty is the spirit which seeks to understand the minds of other men and women. And so I've said be passionate about something and be firm in that passion, but don't be so sure of yourself that you stop being willing to listen to other people. And listen not just with a mind to respond and tell them how they're wrong, but to try to understand their hearts and minds. That's how we win most of these battles that we're talking about again over time. We change hearts and minds by listening, not just by screaming, you know, on Fox News or whatever. So,
well, this is a tremendous lesson in true civic involvement, that it comes out of basic conduct, right? Learning through dialogue, learning through listening. But sometimes we watch, especially around the world, when other countries experience change, that struggle comes violently perhaps, not necessarily through dialogue, largely through debate. And we have a tremendous blessing. You referred to the miraculous system we have. And I think there's a tremendous blessing we have that our system has survived generations of different styles of civic involvement. Everything from leadership to lethargy, everything from passion to partisanship, and every, you know, sort of facet and nuance in between. What issues do you think will pose threats to our institutions in the coming years that give you some alarm or some pause? I'm certain you see, as we do, as observers of the political process and observers of different kinds of civic involvement, that there are concerning moments in that tension between patience and passion. So what gives you those moments of pause? And if you offer a suggestion, I think you'd find some welcome ears here. Perhaps this will be the army of citizens who can go out and make some of those suggestions come to life. So would you share with us what those concerns are? And if you do want to sort of dally into suggestions, feel free. Please.
Yeah, well, just a couple, and I'll try to be brief. But the things that keep me up at night, I do oversee elections in the state, and one of the things that keeps me up at night is a lack of participation in the political process, specifically
scandalous.
When it comes to voting.
It really is.
It's really shocking. But I'll tell you one of the reasons I think that exists, and it's one of the other things that keeps me up at night. We've talked about what makes a good citizen, a good public servant, and what scares me, especially at the national level, by and large, we have just tremendous public servants here in the state of Utah. But we have politicians who define themselves, they've come to define themselves by their position. They can no longer see themselves as just Joe or Mary, you know, so-and-so, but they're Senator so-and-so, they're Congressman so-and-so. And the reason that matters is, if I can't envision my life without this title that I have, then everything I'm going to do is going to make sure that I have that title 2 years from now or 6 years from now or 4 years from now. And I don't care about anybody else except keeping that title, okay? Now, while we are supposed to be, again, beholden to our constituents and we hope you'll all vote for us next time, that's very dangerous when every decision we make is just based on the next election. And what it's led to is we have a group of political leaders who are nothing but talking points, who never say anything real. They just say what they think you want to hear. And as a society, eventually we get tired of that. And we start to lose kind of hope. Why would I participate? It doesn't matter. And I think while I would like to criticize a younger generation for their apathy and their decisions not to vote, I think it's just the opposite. I think we have a political leadership who has led us down that pathway of apathy by just feeding us what we want to hear and never being genuine or real. And that's what keeps me up at night. I don't know how you change that. Run for office.
That's Utah Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW and a panel discussion with Utah lawmakers on the importance of civic involvement. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. You're listening to a panel of Utah lawmakers that includes Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox, Utah Supreme Court Justice Christine Durham, and Utah State Representative Brian King. We now continue with the discussion and the question of what political or social issues are of particular concern to the panelists. This discussion was recorded with an audience of University of Utah students and faculty on April 22, 2014. Again, this is Utah Supreme Court Justice Christine Durham.
Let me speak to an issue that keeps me up at night in terms of the judiciary. Not here in Utah. We have, in my view, the best system, the most fair, objective, and impartial system of selecting good judges in the country. But in 39 of the American states, judges are elected. And you might, in contested elections, the majority of them partisan, some of them nonpartisan, but the majority of them partisan. We are the only country in the world that elects judges. And yet it's an American tradition that goes back to the mid-19th century, and it appears to be one that's here to stay. Most Americans, when they're polled, say that they think electing judges is a really bad idea, but then when you ask them if they're willing to give up their right to vote for judges, they don't want to do it, so we're kind of schizophrenic about it. But the concern that I have is that with the combination of several United States Supreme Court decisions, one about 8 years old now, that basically said judicial elections are like other elections, so that the provisions that used to be that the states put in place to keep judges from making campaign promises, that sort of thing, are at risk. And then you have Citizens United, where the Supreme Court took the lid off of political contributions, the amount of money that people can, that has an impact of judicial elections. And you are seeing an increase, the amount of money that's being spent in judicial elections, especially for state Supreme Courts around the country, has tripled in the last 12 years. And it's often out-of-state money, national money, big corporations, big public interest groups who have decided that it's easier to buy a judge on a state Supreme Court than it is to elect enough legislators to get their agendas passed through the legislative process, and they've targeted the judiciaries. And that, I talked earlier about independence and accountability, and that is a real threat to the independence of judges, which in turn is a potential threat to the rule of law. So that's something I worry about. But as Utahns, the thing I would hope and ask is that you be knowledgeable and be defenders of our system. There are occasional attacks on it. A few years ago, one of your colleagues at the legislature wanted to put the legislature in the mix and have them decide which judges could sit on our retention ballots. And that's not public elections, but it's a very interesting way of selecting judges.
I think these are two great comments, but the thing that, to use this phrase, keeps me up at night more than anything else from a political perspective is the role of disproportionate and unregulated money in our political system. Justice Durham touched on it. I want to read you a quote from... it seems like we're quoting judges today,
Let's
Spencer.
Let's do that. We're good.
This is a great quote that I found, just stuck in a case that was decided by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals 4 years ago, and the author of the decision was Judge Alex Kaczynski. Judge Kaczynski is was appointed, he was a Reagan appointee, and he was, his parents, I believe, came from Bulgaria or someplace in Eastern Europe, but he came from, had a lot of personal experience, and his family had a lot of personal experience with communist rule, and that informed his much of his thinking. He said this, something that's relevant not just to federal judges, although that was to whom the comment was directed, but to all decision makers, I think, at a legislative and executive branch. There's been much talk about diversity on the bench, but there's one kind of diversity that doesn't exist. No truly poor people are appointed as federal judges or as state judges for that matter. Judges, regardless of race, ethnicity, or sex, are selected from the class of people who don't live in trailers or urban ghettos. The everyday problems of people who live in poverty are not close to our hearts and minds because that's not how we and our friends live. Now, that's a powerful thought to me because I do think that we are growing more in the direction of having individuals in positions of authority and decision-making, whether it's the executive branch, the legislative branch, or the judiciary, come from a certain class of society that really is limited in their exposure to, understanding of, and willingness to empathize with those who struggle from on a day-to-day basis to make ends meet. And I think that's at least a potential, if not actual, threat to the stability that we want to maintain in our society, as well as our continued productivity, our general welfare. You know, one of the comments that is critical to me in our Constitution is that one of the purposes of the Constitution is to promote the general welfare. What does that mean? I think it means something other than the sort of divisions in terms of wealth and income inequality that we are seeing growing in this country in the last 30 years. I think we've got to do more, figure out a way to effectively address that growing income and wealth inequality, because I think it's dangerous at so many levels. It's dangerous to our stability. It's dangerous to our fundamental promise of opportunity that we hold out to everyone who is in this society and we invite to come to our country, that they can have equal justice and they can have access to the kind of opportunity that we all want in our lives. And we all want it for our children and our grandchildren. So that's kind of the thing that I am concerned about.
Well, I know that we're drawing near our time. I don't want to lose sight of an audience question or if there's a comment to be made. We certainly have a few other things that we've prepared to talk about, but I'd like to involve our audience, if at all possible, before we conclude. If you'll wait for the microphone to be brought to you and let us know your question or your thought, please.
Hi, my name's Josh. Thanks for coming out today, all three of you. I do have a question on how you view the Count My Vote initiative and how that helps us become, you know, or negates the ability to become an active citizen in politics. Thank you.
Great question.
That's a good question.
I can give you a very schizophrenic answer if you would like. So I come from rural Utah, and one of the things I love about the caucus convention system is one, the ability of kind of the everyday citizen to get involved, and two, because those delegates are so important in rural Utah, and we, most people don't know this, we think we're kind of a rural state. We're not. We're one of the most urban states in the country. But we have all these counties with a very small population. And so the nice thing about living in Fairview, where I live with 1,200 people, is we saw governors and senators and congressmen come and spend time just to get those extra few delegates because that was so important to them. And I worry that, like we have flyover states when it comes to a presidential election, that we'll now have flyover counties. It doesn't make sense for them to waste any time in these small counties when the bulk of the population is here on the Wasatch Front. And now the flip side of that is that the caucus system only works when people show up. And we've already talked about one of the problems is that people aren't showing up. So if the idea is that if a representative set of your community actually shows up to the caucus systems, we're going to end up with basically the same results, only we're going to save money and people will be able to go out to rural Utah. That's not happening. It happened a couple years ago, arguably because we had a senator that spent a lot of money to get people to come out to their caucus system. It's just going to change the dynamic, and we really don't know how that's going to turn out. It will still be easy to get involved. People will still want to listen to you, but money suddenly becomes much more important, because now, instead of going out and standing in someone's living room and talking to them, I'm better off buying a commercial and reaching, you know, a couple hundred thousand people.
I'm going to stay away from this one because we've already had one.
She might have to make a decision on
this. One challenge when it was a potential initiative to the Count My Vote effort that our court had to rule on. Now, the legislature, as I understand from reading the newspapers, has in fact passed some legislation. But just in case, I'll keep my views to myself.
SB 54, which was the bill that just passed the legislature, I think was a very good compromise that attempted to address the concerns of both sides of this equation. I like having in place some level of caucus involvement. It's helpful, I think, to have an opportunity in March every other year, that is, for caucuses to meet and to come together and give an opportunity for folks in their community, in their neighborhoods, to get together and have their say. I think that's a very helpful thing in terms of participatory democracy, in terms of encouraging involvement at a very grassroots level. I also think it's an important thing to provide a separate avenue to get a name of an incumbent in front of the voters at a primary election, if not a direct election, the final general election. We saw great grievance, great heartburn associated with the fact that an incumbent U.S. senator didn't even have a chance to get past the delegates at a convention before getting tossed off the ballot. That's a valid concern. And I like the idea that SB 54 and Count My Vote, which was superseded by SB 54, provided that avenue. I also like the idea, however, that SB 54 does something that Count My Vote would have wiped out, which is preserve the caucus system. So I think SB 54 is actually a very good compromise that attempts to provide some balance there.
Thank you. It looks like we have another comment or question.
Hi, my name is Jack Patterson. I'm a student here at the university, and I had a question regarding, it was brought up when we talked about social media briefly, that now that you have such wide access to media, people are able to better cherry pick what they want to hear from different media sources. So I was wondering how this impacts civic engagement and what the best way to counteract sort of the partisan sway of many media organizations has. Thanks.
Yeah. You know, that's a wonderful question, and I think we all sort of alluded to that. And there have been some very popular books written on the subject of divisions in America, and you alluded to the class system and the money basis of it, but the ideological basis of it is extreme. I mean, increasingly, we Americans, we listen to the news outlets where our point of view gets ratified. We engage with other human beings who look like us and talk like us. We live in neighborhoods that are increasingly homogenized. I don't know what the answer to it is, except the thing that's been alluded to before, which is to be very conscious about our willingness to get out of our comfort zones. Now, the problem for me is this will mean that I would have to listen to Fox News more often than I do. And this would be very hard on me. I might have blood pressure issues, but I do... myself try very hard to keep up with, to the extent I can, with points of view that are different from mine. But whether we can solve that, you know, individual by individual doing that, I don't know, or whether there are things we can do institutionally. I'll see if my colleagues have some ideas.
Well, it's the great irony that we're now more connected than ever, and we're using those connections to become more isolated than ever. That worries me tremendously, and I don't know what the end. There's a great book called The End of Big. If you get a chance to read it, you should. It talks about how this interconnectedness, social media, the internet, is being used to destroy our institutions, for better or worse. Sometimes it's great that the changes that are happening, and sometimes it's not great the changes that are happening. And so again, I think we have to make a personal commitment to that ourselves, and then kind of spread that gospel. And I tell people, you know, I tend to run with the crowd that listens to Fox News a little more than others.
I should say my father tells me everything right. They say, so I do keep up.
But that's what I say. I say, look, for every hour of that you watch, you've got to watch something else. You really do, and you have to make a concerted effort to do that, because what's happening is the business side of this is really monopolizing on our attention spans. And so it's easier to make money when I tell you what you want to hear. And it goes back to the candidates and something that Justice Durham said earlier about how the candidates can drill down and know by zip code, by house. It's scary how much candidates know about you individually if they want to. Just by paying enough money, they can find out what magazines you read, you know, what websites you visit. I mean, you can learn a lot about somebody. And then I can tell you exactly what you want to hear. And so we have to make that conscious decision that, again, the spirit of liberty is not to be too sure we're right, but the spirit of liberty is to listen to the hearts and minds of other people. And I don't know how else to do that. We just have to do it on our own.
You've been listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. This program was brought to you by the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah and KCPW. You can hear this program again and other podcasts on KCPW's website, and join us every Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. to hear more engaging forums and speakers on political and legal issues affecting Utah. I'm Ross Jamblis, and this is KCPW.